My name is Dee Bechtel, and the title of this session is Christ is a Feminist. Now, that's a rather amazing position for some people. However, maybe not so amazing. There is a book that I didn't find out about in time to order it for the bookstore, but I would certainly recommend your looking at it if you're interested in this topic. It's called Christian Feminism, Visions of a New Humanity. It's a series of articles by several different theologians, and it's edited by Judith L. Weidman, W-E-I-D-M-A-N. That's has been the source of much of the material that I'm going to be using today. But I certainly don't hold myself out as an expert on the subject. I want this to be a discussion, and I would like your contributions as well. I hope to present some ideas that may or may not be new to you, and feel free to jump in anytime with questions or comments of your own so that we can all kind of explore this topic together. Oh, it just occurred to me that I forgot to bring this amazing article from the newspaper. Anyway, I cut out an article from the newspaper that showed a statue that was called Christa. And it was a Christ statue in the form as if the Christ were on the crucifix, and it has breasts. Mm-hmm. And the article was talking about, I guess it was put up in, or it was created for an Episcopalian church, I believe it was in New York somewhere. And the article was about the reaction, the strong reaction, both very pro and very con, to this statue. I'm not sure I'm ready to go that far. I don't know that I want to see Christ as a female necessarily, but I think it's important to look at the feminist aspects of Christ, the aspects of Christ that include all people of all races and creeds, and to question a bit some of the traditions that have been handed down to us that emphasize the maleness of Christ rather than the humanness of Christ. I'd like to start out by using a technique that is recommended by one of the authors in the Christian Feminist book. Her name is Rita Nakashima Brock, and I understand she is a professor of theology at Valparaiso University. She describes a situation where, in order to sensitize a group that was composed of men and women, they started out by talking about their feelings about rape. That may seem to you a bit of an unusual technique, but let's do it, and then we'll talk about why we're doing that later. I have never been raped, but I have talked to women who have, and I have heard some of the hurt and some of the absolute feelings of tearing apart, like tearing out your guts, that have been experienced by people who have been raped. My understanding of it is that it must be like taking away the most precious, the most intimate part of me when someone rapes me or raped anyone. Are there any others of you who would like to share, either if you have had a close friend or been touched closely in some way by rape, or if you would be so brave as to share it if you have been raped yourself? Yes.
I have a close friend, two friends who were both raped, and it's not a thing that is, there's one young woman who still is dealing with it after a couple, 3 years. Another friend is, you're never quite the same if you don't want to be. I also know a third woman who for a while, who was a very remarkable woman who seems to be fine about it after maybe 6 months. But the other two women still deal with it a lot and are afraid to be alone some of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's such a total violation of your body. And you don't know whether to fight and you feel like a fool if you don't. And dealing with police is horrible and much of that. But I think some of that has changed quite a bit. But it's an experience that I think about and I think how fortunate I haven't been. And in LA it's something that we have to be aware of a lot, and I moved through the world differently because of my sisters who were raped.
Anybody else care to share a feeling that you know of personally or something that has touched you closely having to do with rape?
Another thing that I consider, I think it's important for each one of us. I have women friends who are relatively unconscious about the possibility of rape, and it makes me furious when I'm talking to them. I remember one time we were in another woman's car, and I said, let's just lock our doors. And they said, oh, Margaret, you're always seeing, something behind every bush. And it makes me mad. That's stupid. And yet, I think it's still up to us if we're conscious about it. It's up to us to make our sisters aware that there is that possibility. And so I know some people think I'm just a fool about certain things, but before anything else, when I get in the car, I lock it, and I always check out the area. If I park there during the day, I check out the area because I want to see if it's a place I'm going to come out to after dark. Because, chances are I might be, having to do that. And just walking in a very forthright manner and having keys and stuff like that. But Lord knows what I do. Somebody grabbed me. I fight like hell, but I'm going to shoot.
Well, you don't have to be outside like that to be
that's
rape,
true.
Either. You have to be in your own house.
I lived in a small town 3 years ago, and one of our very fine girls just came out of a college library and was raped while she went to her car. And yet I've been in Israel, and again I felt safe during the evening. Because it's not a common thing in some of the foreign countries, but it's taken over in America. Evidently there's more emphasis on sex here than most places.
But it's not fundamentally a sexual crime, it's fundamentally a violent crime.
Well, right, because I can remember so much in Sweden, their society, we're all Scandinavian, so open about that. It's a lot different. With us, it's some of this false puritanical history we have. It's such a sick that up there it's real open again.
What I have heard from people who have been involved with rape, either themselves or working on some of the rape crisis lines and those kinds of things, are that frequently it takes a long time for a woman to learn how to relate with males again, because somehow there's a real fear that this too may be a person who is going to subject me to this worst kind of violence I can possibly imagine. And there's a whole lot of fear and a lot of anger happening for a long time afterwards. My understanding of what Rita Brock was saying in her article was that this sensitizing on the issue of rape is important for males and females to talk together about, because it has to do with the whole dominant and submissive roles that males and females generally play in our society. That it helps males to understand by hearing females talk about rape and fear and anger, that how much we feel and get angry about being in submission and being in a helpless position in relation to a male. And she uses that to contrast with the feminist image, what she classifies as a feminist image, and I realize that I haven't defined feminism as such, but maybe we could do that from several angles without, you know, giving you a whole definition about feminism is until the end. She sees the feminist image as not this dualism, not this dominant submissive kind of thing, but a whole person, a healed person. And it's that that she uses to relate to Christ, because she says then that Christ is the healer. Christ is not the representative of the dominant submissive or the dualism, the either or, the right or wrong kind of thinking, but Christ is representative of inclusiveness of all people, of all genders, and of all races. You know, this is the wholeness, the healing, and this is relating really, as far as I can see, to the theme here at Holden this summer, that we are all included. We've heard even last week that it's not even all human beings, and they're not only all human beings, but also including the animal kingdom and maybe the plant kingdom. And some of us were hearing Ed Seni last night talk about Indian religions and their reverence for all of life and all of the creation. And I think that's included in the feminist idea as well, the wholeness, the unity of all aspects. And Rita Brock goes on to talk about how that affects the view of what salvation is. Because if you have this idea that the world is categorized into right and wrong, or dualism, or either or, then salvation is getting on the right side. Salvation is moving from the wrong side to the right side. But if you have this idea about the feminist kind of image, that the salvation then or is wholeness, you can be moving to wholeness. Wholeness is never a place that you arrive at totally, but it's part of a process. And it also accepts a lot of the fallibilities of ourselves. It accepts our vulnerability. And in some cases, maybe it encourages our vulnerability, because it's only through being vulnerable to each other and sharing deeply with each other that we can move toward that wholeness. And that's a very different idea of salvation than most of us were brought up with. I like the comment recently of a friend here at Holden who was saying the other day that she looks at people who are good people, who do good things in the world, but who may tell you that they're agnostic and would deny hotly that they're Christian. And I have met people that look at those folks and say, you know, they really need to get the right word. We need to tell them what's right, you know, we need to bring enlightenment to them, even though they are really good people and doing a lot of good things and being concerned for a lot of people in the world. And her word was, she considers these people pre-Christian. And I really liked that. I thought, yes, that kind of thing has troubled me for some time. You know, how can I possibly look at someone who is doing a lot of good things and being very caring and concerning, and then say, no, obviously that person is wrong because they deny Christ. Maybe they just haven't worked that far towards wholeness yet, but they probably will. That helps me to accept them, and probably helps them to accept me a whole lot too. Rita Brock also says that feminist theology looks at life and draws theology from life, rather than setting up some kind of ideal or value system and then applying that to life. And this kind of setting up the ideal oftentimes leads to some contradictions in the world, it seems to me, and not accepting a whole lot of what's in the gray area. the world is rarely ever black and white, in my opinion, that much of what we experience is somewhere in that in-between area. And feminist theology tends to look at all of the gray area and look at the process that's involved, rather than necessarily needing to categorize things into nice, neat little boxes. She quotes another author, Susan Griffin, who wrote a book called Pornography and Silence, talking about the pornographic mind. And I was a bit startled at that term originally, because I think of pornography as dirty pictures in books. But she classifies this dualistic thinking as a pornographic mind, and goes on to talk about the pornographic mind as something that is fed by fear of itself, fear of its own vulnerability, and so it projects that fear on others who may be different from it, or who remind it, that is the pornographic mind, of its own vulnerability. And this leads then to feeling fearful of anything that's different from the person with this mindset, just because they remind it of its own vulnerability, and therefore it's really basically afraid of itself. And that seemed to me to really fit some of this, getting back to the idea of rape and how that fits in. The violence feeds on itself because it's not necessarily related to anything out there, and this has to do with the uncertainty, why we're afraid of the unpredictability of the possibility of rape in our society, because there's all this person who's so afraid of his own vulnerability that he's feeding on his own fear, and that just leads in a snowballing effect to the violence. She contrasts that, and this is again Susan Griffin's thinking, that the pornographic mind then is contrasted to what she calls eros, which is the Greek word for love, which she sees as a basic yearning for connection to others, and of discovering more about yourself. And she says that is found by reclaiming your own sensuality, reclaiming your own self-affirmation and change and passion. And she sees these then as the healthy way of moving toward life, that rather than the fear feeding on itself and getting deeper and deeper into the violent part of ourselves, we look at our own ability to change and accept our own ability to change, so that we can begin to affirm ourselves. Another author in the Christian feminism book is Rosemary Ruther, and some of you may be familiar with some of her work. But
she was here a few years ago.
Was she really?
Oh, I think she was here for about 3 summers.
Huh. I have never heard her speak. Can you give us an idea about some of the things that you...
Well, there isn't anything very gentle about her. She's very caustic.
Mm-hmm.
And, but very intelligent, brilliant person.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I think she wasn't invited back was because she wasn't empathetic with the person who spoke their opinion if she differed from them.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Some of her tapes, I think, are back.
Yes, I'm sure the tapes are back there.
Hmm. Hmm. I don't know if she spoke here on the subject of feminist theology or not. Did she, as far as you know?
Well, it was very clear that she was a feminist, yes, but mm-hmm. I don't know if she zeroed in on that particular thing.
Yeah.
But a very interesting person.
Mm-hmm.
She's a Catholic,
mm-hmm.
and a writer. She wrote for the Catholic Digest for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can certainly understand how someone in a tradition, or who wanted to remain connected to a tradition that doesn't allow women to be in positions of authority might get a little bitter about this. Yes.
Makes you real
costly.
Also, she has decided to stay within the tradition, the Christian tradition, whereas mm-hmm. Mary Daly has
yes.
opted to go out, so that she might tend to be not as patient or whatever with some things, and mm-hmm. that she wants to stay within the tradition, but finds it very difficult to deal with some of the things that she thinks we should move on in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, my understanding of Mary Daly is that she started out trying to reform the Catholic Church and pretty much gave up at
yes.
that, and she's on trying to reform something else now because it was a hopeless cause as far as she was concerned.
Yeah, that's
like I'm a Lutheran. Yeah, right.
Well, it seems like some people just have to be angry
mm-hmm.
to do their thing, and mm-hmm. I think that's Rosemary Ruther.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the article in the book on Christian feminism, Ruther is talking about something about that anger, and if I can find a quote that I wrote down from her, she says, "Feminist theology starts with the affirmation that God, the ground of being and new being, underlies, includes, supports, and promotes female personhood as much as male personhood." Now that isn't, well, I guess for some people that may be a radical statement, but I would underline the words "as much as." She's not saying more than, that female personhood is necessarily more important than male personhood, but it's on an equal basis. And I think the church has for a long time, we have for a long time, denied that females are as important as males, and that has to do with some of our problems with ordination, that females don't typify the Christ figure as much, therefore they should not be a pastor, etc. But Ruther did say in her article that therefore woman is equivalent to man as imago Dei, the image of God. And that may be a more revolutionary statement for some people, because for some people it's really hard to look at even feminine images of God in the Bible and accept them, or at least we haven't heard as much about the feminine images of God in the Bible as the male images. Ruther goes on to talk about sin then being sexism or alienation or oppression. And I would guess this is where she gets into the anger, because it's real easy, if you are one of the oppressed, if you are one of the alienated from positions of authority, or even simply if your ideas, if you're interested in having your ideas heard, and there are people out there that are saying, no, your ideas aren't as good because they are coming out of a mouth that is attached to a feminine body rather than a masculine one, I can understand where you'd get a little angry. She sees this is back to Rita Brock then, that is talking about the traditional view. In the traditional view, Christ is seen as static perfection, an image or an ideal that we can hold up that doesn't change. And she contrasts that then to the feminist view, that Christ is a process. Christ is the liberator God, who is, well, in some ways the Exodus God, who is rising up the oppressed and bringing people out of bondage in order to achieve wholeness. Brock also talks about what she classifies as unholy goodness, which I thought was interesting. She sees that as the holding up this ideal and then living, trying, or being told that you need to live up to the ideal, even though you had no input as to what that ideal ought to be, which is what I see as the process that theologians have gone through for centuries, excluding women from input as to what the ideals and what the standards are, and then saying, you women need to live up to those ideals, even if you didn't have anything to say about what went into those ideals. She says it's destructive for oppressed people because we can't feel angry about our oppression. If we feel oppressed but don't have any way to act out that anger or act out or get out of that oppression, then again we're into the cycle of anger and frustration and more fear. She says when the dominant values of society are not ours but are used as a measuring rod for our right to justice, then we become self-haters and haters of others. Brock would say we need to reject the absolute and be free to respond to reality from our own experience. And that is the strength of feminism or feminist theology, rather than allegiance to an ideal, or excuse me, not allegiance to an ideal, but a statement of what we have experienced, and including our experience of oppression. Again, getting back to the rape analogies, the feeling that we are the oppressed people, we are the people who are living in fear but not able to do anything about that. And that's what leads to the anger, that's what leads to the frustration, because we feel helpless in trying to combat those feelings of frustration and oppression. All of these, a lot of this thinking then leads us to the conclusion that we need to look closely at a lot of what we have accepted as the tradition of Christianity, the traditional views, and really analyze as to whether that's validly based on what the Bible has to say. They use the example, I think it's Brock that used the example of Christ is not somebody in a three-piece suit trying to be a success in our modern world. Christ was the person who came to overthrow a lot of the traditions, or to say, look, established church of the time that he was on earth, you're all wrong. You're heading in the wrong direction because you have forgotten the basis on which this church was based. And I suspect that Christ would say many of those same things to the churches today. We have become so enmeshed in tradition. We have become so enmeshed in that's the way we've always done it, that we are sometimes pretty angry and pretty unwilling to look at a new idea or to consider a new perspective. Obviously, Christ wasn't in a three-piece suit, or wouldn't be today. He would be out there being the rabble-rouser, being the person who challenged the church authorities and saying, you hypocrites, look what you're doing. Look how you have really gone against the basis, the underpinnings of what those traditions started to be all about. Yes?
The last several sentences you've done, is your position that he would be against because what is going on is somehow not right, or is it because it is inherent in Christ to be the process? In other words, there's a lot has been said about the, and I admit to strong lack of understanding what feminist theology is, but in this idea of a process.
Mm-hmm.
Christ is the process, and in effect, the change, a change, but inherently a change agent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and is he trying to change this because it is fundamentally, it has somehow gotten to a point where it is wrong, or is he challenging it because he remains truly a constant change agent? I think those are two different ideas.
Right, right. If I'm understanding what your dilemma is, I'm not saying at all that change for change's sake is the important thing. But I am saying that what Christ was trying to tell us is not one ideal that can be true for all time forever, because the world is a changing place. And so I believe what Christ would be saying to us now, or is saying to us now, is not necessarily exactly the same as what he said 2,000 years ago. Because if he were here today, the message would be different because the situation is different. The other part of that is that I believe that Christ would say to a lot of our traditions that we are worshiping those traditions rather than worshiping the Christ who was supposedly the basis of those traditions. We are doing the same thing with the word as the Pharisees had done at the time 2,000 years ago, that they had gotten so, they had built up such a holiness of their own traditions that they had really just violated the basis of those traditions, which was God.
And so fundamentally you are fairly strongly in agreement with the idea that there's a lot wrong with the traditions in themselves.
Yes. Yes.
Well, not Go ahead. Necessarily wrong with the tradition, but wrong with what we've done with it, which is to make it our God.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think that's what, that I don't know if the message Jesus would have is any different than the message he had in the first place. If that was, but I think it would be put in language that was applicable to our day.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the principle is always the same.
Mm-hmm.
To restore the fellowship of human beings to God.
Right.
And the reason that we're, I mean, what's occurred that has kept us out of fellowship has a lot to do with our worship traditions,
mm-hmm.
often.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we don't have the same traditions those Pharisees had, but we have made a God of ours.
Of our traditions.
Many times.
Mm-hmm.
Or we, you know, not just traditions, a lot of things in life.
Mm-hmm.
We just get it confused about what's the reality and what's this thing that I hang on to because I'm comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other comments? The other thing that I thought was interesting about what Rosemary Ruther had to say was on the question of sexist language. She says, sexist language is idolatry because it limits God. If we insist upon God being only he or father or whatever other limiting image that we have of God, that's setting up a God of the language. That's making language itself the God rather than looking behind to who or what God really is or what God was trying to tell us about who God is. And I thought that was interesting because it seems to me that that's a real hang-up in terms of even some people who can accept some of the language changes. And we were doing the workshop, when was it, a couple of days ago, about the inclusive language lectionary. And we were, in that session, focusing more on the language about people and how it might be appropriate to change some of the language in the lectionary referring to people so that we can be more inclusive of the people who are worshiping, the people who are hearing that lectionary. But one of the other things that the inclusive language lectionary does is change some of the wording about God in a lot of cases, simply replacing some of the traditional names, father or king or some of those kinds of images, with just simply the word God, getting back to God rather than some of the other images that we have used come to associate with God traditionally, and some of us hang on to very closely because we're comfortable with those images. And I really appreciate Ruther's statement that that's really limiting God. It really is. We are putting God in our nice, neat little box and making us comfortable rather than considering what God is. Again, she goes on to talk about God as the liberator the Exodus God, the God who reached down through Christ to contact us and to say, this is what I am like. This is how I want you to see me through Christ as he was in his time, or at the time of his incarnation. But forgetting a lot about the, you know, that he was speaking to a specific situation then, and he might speak differently to our situation. She sees Christology, that is, the study of Christ, as an incarnation inclusive of all human beings. And this made me think about, there are, I guess, I have never seen them, but I understand that people in some other cultures have made statues of Christ, or even statues, for instance, of the Nativity scene, that puts Asian faces, slanty eyes, on the figures in that Nativity scene, or a black Christ. I don't think that's blasphemy. I really think, and maybe that includes the Christa figure with the breasts, if you like, if you want to go that far, but I think that makes Christ inclusive. I like the idea that Christ really does include the Asian, that he might have slanty eyes as he appears to see to some people, and he might have the figures of, and the appearance of a black person so that he can relate to people in that culture. I get offended a bit at some of the, what some people put out as pictures of Jesus that really show him looking very Northern European, when I know that he was not at all Northern European. But I think I'm troubled a bit by the fact that we seem to think that we need to look at him in that way so that we can accept him more, rather than accepting the fact that he was very Jewish, obviously. He was born into the Jewish culture at that time. You have other comments or questions or things that you'd like to talk about? Yes.
Some examples of Christ as a feminist in his time?
Yes. Things like, for example, well, one of the more astounding ones, as far as I know, is the Samaritan woman at the well, where he astounded the disciples by talking to a woman, primarily, and the Bible clearly says that they were amazed that he was talking to a woman. But then not only did he talk to her, he went back to her village with her, and she was the agent then that brought a lot of people from that village to be believers in him, even though there was a great division between the Jews and the Samaritans at that time. I mean, they were really warring factions, or not warring, but they hated each other generally in society. Some of the other things, for example, that he appeared first to a woman after his resurrection. A woman was the first witness to the resurrection. And this book doesn't go into it, but I understand from other sources that there have even been people that looked back into the history and can document the fact that there was at least one woman apostle, and that there were women in leadership roles early on in the church. But those were, they were shoved out a bit, or not allowed later on in the church then to have more positions of authority. Other questions or comments?
I think one of the problems, oftentimes Christ is presented as the forgiver of sins, and as a strong male human being as mm-hmm. the forgiver of sins. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of the reason there's a problem with accepting women in ordination, because how can a woman forgive my sins when it is Christ who is the male figure who is my forgives my sins? Mm-hmm. But then that also, if it is a male who forgives, then it is I who is a female who is the one who needs sins forgiven, mm-hmm. because I am inferior or I am lesser.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, men may feel this, but the feelings that I get is often the fact that if I am an inferior person because this Christ, this or Jesus, you know, is a male forgiver of my sins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When if we look beyond that,
when
then
I look beyond that, I'm
sure.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And
but
I work beyond that.
Yes.
But that's get us up.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I really agree. For me, that's a real strong reason why I have ordination of women, because we're limiting God if we're talking about Jesus as a male was part of God. I'm not sure. Well, the fact, obviously, he was a male human being in his incarnation at that time, but I don't think that's the important thing. His maleness is not the important part about him. The fact that he was God is the important thing. And that's an incarnation into humanity rather than an incarnation into maleness. And I think it's just a shift of emphasis that is helpful to me because, again, I'm not being as limiting of God. Other comments? Questions?
Well, on the other hand, Jesus' incarnation as a male human being could be pushed in the direction that in that very incarnation, he had to be incarnate probably to be accepted in one gender or the other.
Sure.
But he incorporated into his humanity,
mm-hmm.
both male and female characteristics, and I think maybe the church has lost something over the years because we haven't emphasized that fact.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of Jesus' ministry, especially the way Luke records it, reveals a great deal of what we commonly ascribe to women. Tenderness, mm-hmm. nurturing, mm-hmm. care for women, mm-hmm. all that kind of thing. And if indeed in our Bible exegesis begin to point those things up, I think in many ways it helps us in our relations with other human beings because we don't need to make such severe sexual role distinctions
mm-hmm.
among any people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, traditionally we really give little boys who are a little more gentle a hard time, and little girls...
Or we worry about them maybe becoming homosexuals or whatever.
Yeah, all that kind of nonsense. And sometimes, as a middle-aged woman, I really resent the fact that the perpetual battle between homosexuality and heterosexuality and all that stuff now has arrived at such a state, at least in our culture, that if you happen to be, I have to speak from a woman's point of view, if you happen to be a woman and you happen to have a very close, intimate relationship with another woman that has nothing at all to do with sex,
mm-hmm.
you always have to be a little standoffish, you know.
Right.
The same is true for men, mm-hmm. but I mean,
yes.
I'm,
it may be more true for men.
That annoys me.
Yeah.
That annoys me.
Yeah.
That you know, that you, because I think there's good biblical images for a lot of different kinds of whatever they call it, you know, kinds of love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we try to think of how Christ would be if he was in our day. Well, I wonder if we place some of the phobias we have now in our day back to Christ's day, if there would have been a lot of talk about Christ's relationship in the 12th.
Good point, yes, because I think...
They had very intimate close relationships,
yes.
And they especially had that with John.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
I just wondered if we would have...
Good point. Yes, because I think what you were saying about a woman fearing a close relationship with a woman is even more true for a man. I think that, at least from my observation, that there really are a lot of assumptions or maybe questioning about when a man has a close relationship with another man or goes around hugging another man a whole lot. men really are not very free to do that.
Well, and also the relationship between men and women. I mean, Christ's relationship with Mary Magdalene was something that a lot of people thought was just terrible, and yet he exemplified that kind of love, which doesn't have to be sexual, which can be a very intimate love. And I wish more people would look at that relationship and see it to what it is.
And also very accepting in Mary Magdalene of a very sinful person, you know, according to the society of her day.
Question just came up in my mind. I wonder if Christ coming as a woman in that society would have been as effective as he was.
Oh, I'm sure not, because women had nothing to say in authority. You know, that was certainly even a great contrast with the amount of authority women are allowed to have today, you know, that a woman simply did not speak, was not allowed to be an authoritative person. So, I'm sure that in that time, to have Christ actually incarnate in the body of a woman would not have accomplished what I assume his purpose was. He really did, in a dramatic way, contrasting him with what was the traditional male role in his society. He was much more accepting of women than the males in his society generally. Thank you for coming. I hope this stirs up more discussion.